later.
Make us sound smart, all right?
Welcome to the world's premier Black Crowes podcast. State of America. Hosted by two of the band's most dedicated fans, David Hudson and Ian Rice. And now, let's get the show on the road.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the State of America podcast. I am one of your hosts, Ian Rice, and with me, as always, Mr. David Hudson. David, how are you, sir?
I am great, Mr. Rice.
It is lovely to see you, my friend.
Yes, sir. Right back at you.
We are in the midst of the beginning of the Happiness Bastards tour, and so far so good, in my opinion.
Yeah, man, we had a huge turnout for the opening night in Nashville. 30 plus people, I think, at Scoreboard in Nashville. I want to thank everybody that came to that. We gave away a lot of good stuff. Special shout out to our new friend, Crystal.
Yes.
She made the effort to get there. It was really nice to meet her. We're pulling for you. We're praying for you. And it was very nice to meet you, and hope you had fun at the show, and hope you enjoyed the stuff you came home with.
Yes, I'm very glad that we were able to contribute to her enjoyment of that evening. I know it was a very big undertaking for her to make that trip and taking the show, given her situation. And I'm really glad to see in the aftermath that she did enjoy herself, our meetup included in that.
Yeah, man, it was great. The weather was terrible, but we had a great time. Shout out to my new friend Christy for the ticket hookup. That was nice. It's my first time. I've been up against the rail before, but I've never been front row before for a show. I had a blast. My hearing is just now recovering from it, but that's okay. I've got two ears.
Yeah. So as everybody's aware, quickly David did a road report revisited for the opening night, and we will be continuing those on sporadically throughout the tour.
And if Brian Rosenberg did it with me, and we got back to he was staying at the same hotel, and we just went into the gym and sat there on a weight bench, and I held my phone between the two of us, and we knocked it out. No, the adrenaline was flowing, but it was fun. We had a good time. They've played all but Bleed It Dry already off the new album. I think you're guaranteed about five songs a night, it looks like, from the album. They translate really well live. I was reading online, somebody that wasn't necessarily a fan of the new album said that they thought the songs were a lot better live. So I got Rats and Clowns, I got Bedside Manners, I got Wanting and Waiting, Flesh Wound. Lainey Wilson came out and did Wilted Rose, which, man, I'm telling you, that was a cool moment. You could tell she was nervous, and you could tell she really enjoyed it. And I called it like 2 weeks ahead of time. I checked her schedule. She wasn't going to be on tour. I was like, there's no way they can mess this up. So it was great. And she did. She Talks to Angels, did a great job on it. She's the hottest thing in country music right now. And, it's a big deal that she performed with them. It got press and a lot of YouTube views and stuff like that. So it was fun. I had a great time. Like I said, it was nice to see everybody. They're going to be doing a State of America meetup before the Chicago show, which is at the Aragon Ballroom.
Yes, that is on April 19th.
Yes, at Fat Cats, 4 p.m. local time. They've got a big crew.
So I'm sending Jason some stuff to give away, and there's going to be a special event-specific little sticker for everybody, too, that we designed and being shipped to Jason as well.
And Ian, you've got one coming up in New York, right?
That's right. Still just finalizing the location. I have selected a spot. I'm just making sure that I'm going to take a little dry run into Manhattan prior to, and just make sure that it's conducive to getting to the venue in a good amount of time. For all I can tell so far, it's only a couple minutes walk. So I just want to make sure that everything's in line, make it convenient, make sure the place is suitable for our needs as well.
So with it being in New York, surely you guys are going to have the biggest and best crowd, right?
Don't call me Shirley. I thought you'd know my name by now. But, New York shows, by their own admission, are always some of their better shows. They also do very well in Boston as well. So, yeah, hopefully it's going to be a higher energy as they have been. And, they'll be amped up because they're in New York. But, by the same token, you know, a lot of their best shows happen, you know, in places you wouldn't necessarily think they would, that would be the highlight date. You know what I mean?
I guess it just depends on the mood.
Well, I mean, you got a very special night because you were opening night. There's always a, you know, fervor that goes on opening night, a big anticipatory excitement that's there, you know?
Yeah, got first time played with Wilted Rose, Cross Your Fingers, and Flesh Wound. Flesh Wound had everybody up and going.
Well, it seems like they have spots that they're rotating in and out, catalog material, and you know, some interesting choices. Like Then She Said My Name popped up in there, which is a kind of a rarity. Mm-hmm. And Come On popped up the other evening, which not necessarily my particular favorites or your particular favorites, but it's interesting to see oddball choices like that. It makes me hopeful for what's to come and that they'll keep rotating in and out things each night, as opposed to, you know, a handful of things that they go back and forth to.
Horsehead got played, Only Halfway to Everywhere got played. The covers have been a little odd. Guys at White Light, White Heat, for me, they did a song called Carol last night.
Are you not familiar with that song? It's a Chuck Berry song, but it was done by the Stones.
Yeah, and didn't Tom Petty do it too?
Yeah.
I'm just saying, if you're in the rock vein, you would think kind of there would want to play rock songs that are a little bit more well-known by the common person.
I mean, I feel like, and I totally understand your point, I feel like that song is more well-known than you might realize, though, because the Stones did it, and it was a hit for the Stones early on, and also the Dead used to do it. It's one of those Chuck Berry songs that a lot of bands have hit on over the years, so I think there's some familiarity with it. But I mean, I get what you're saying. There's something maybe a little more contemporary in line with their major influences.
Yeah, I kind of want them to bring back Hey, Hey, What Can I Do, Torn and Frayed, and some stuff like that. I kind of thought that maybe a 1972 song would have showed up, but it hasn't.
I keep expecting Easy to Slip to pop in there, but then that would mean a Rich vocal. And so far, Rich hasn't really stepped up for a lead vocal yet.
So maybe the only one that I know of that he's done was that show, I think, in Philadelphia on the first run where he did Oh Sweet Nothing. And when I understand, they recorded it.
Yeah. So and maybe he's not up for it these days, you know, who knows? But, you know, some of us would like to see that. I always up for a Rich vocal. You think it would give Chris a little break too, you know?
I mean, Chris is into it. You can say, you know, people are upset about the set list and some things like that. But man, he's into it. He's giving it his all. He's moving around like he's 30 years younger. It sounds great, in my opinion.
Well, there's a very weird thing happening and that I don't quite understand. And, you know, it's to be expected. But some people will say either they went to a show and they weren't interested in the new record, but they went to a show anyway, and then they were disappointed in the set list material, this or that. It's like, I feel as though if your focus is primarily on the quote-unquote classic era, you know, the 92 to 97 thing, that's totally cool. And focus on that and live with that. And that's, you know, everybody's got a kind of an era that they rest on. But I don't understand the going to something you know you're not going to enjoy. It's just, you know, why put yourself through that? It doesn't make sense to me. And, you know, not only that, but some of these folks too seem to be like, if you're a fan that is interested in the new record and is going to these shows, that like there's something wrong with you or something like that. But I feel that either way is okay. I'm a longtime fan of this band. I listened to the new record. I enjoyed it. I appreciated Sven's enthusiasm for everything when we spoke to him. And it's something I'm interested in doing. It doesn't mean that I'm somehow some kind of sheep or something like that. And then it's a weird thing with the fan base sometimes that this kind of stuff goes on.
Man, it is what it is. I mean, you're passionate about it because it's meant something to you. So that passion, you know, you can be passionately happy or you can, you know, be passionately wish it was something else. I, like a lot of things, fall kind of in the middle on it. I would like to see a little bit deeper cuts and maybe stretch it out to 20 songs, but I had a lot of fun. It's one of the most fun shows I've ever been to. Oh, we forgot to mention Seth and Trent are going to have their band playing Crow's Tunes the afternoon of the Boston show right across the street.
Yes. So they will be at Loretta's, which is across from the MGM Music Hall, where the Crows will be performing on Saturday, April 28th. They're going to get started about 4:30 in the afternoon. You definitely want to go over there and check that out. They put on a hell of a performance, and it's a nice little appetizer for the main event. You know what I mean? So this week, we were lucky enough to have two guests with us, both from the Steepwater band. We have Jeff and Joe from that band, two lovely gentlemen. Had a great chat with them. They actually have a tour coming up in support of Mark Ford.
Yeah, I had a little bit of a snafu, so I missed the first part of the interview. I come in toward the end.
I mean, I wasn't going to bring it up, David, because I don't like to shame you publicly. But yes, David does roll in eventually. But we had a good time. Jason and I carried the first half, and then all three of us were there for the second half. And a lot of really cool Crow stories. These guys and their band have been tied to the Crows for a very, very long time in a lot of interesting ways. And their latest record is quite good, and I encourage anybody to go out and check it out. That's the Steepwater Band, and they'll definitely be back in the future in some capacity. We love chatting with them, and we'll happily do it again.
It was a good time.
Yeah, well, for the part you were there for.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, so we appreciate you joining us for this one. Hope you enjoy this interview with Joe and Jeff from Steepwater, and we will see you next time. All right, everybody, we are pleased to welcome two gentlemen. One is a returning guest of ours, but I was not present on that episode, so this is a first for me. But these two gentlemen are from a fantastic band called the Steepwater Band. Please welcome Joe and Jeff. Fellas, how you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Wonderful.
Doing good, for sure. Thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. It's a real treat. I've been following the band for many, many years. Actually, probably around the time Grace and Melody came out, because obviously being a Crows fan, that kind of came into the sphere of things, because that album was produced by Mark Ford.
Yes, it was cool.
How did that all come to be? How did you guys hook up with Mark in the beginning? Because you've worked with him, you know, over the course of the last several years in various capacities.
Let me preface it with, it was pretty organic and just kind of happened. It was really serendipitous and how it all kind of happened, because we originally started our band. We original bass player Todd and myself met Jeff at a Black Crowes concert in 1996 at the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago. That's where the whole idea of trying to get together and make the band started. So the idea that 12 years, 10 years, whatever it was later, we would be working with Mark Ford in a studio making a record was pretty crazy. But go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, basically we were booked on a festival in northern Spain, in Sestao, Spain. We were headlining the fest, and it was Eric Sardinas and Mark Ford were on the fest. And then I think in addition to that, we were already scheduled to play with Mark in Chicago like 2 weeks after that, if I'm not mistaken. And we were on this festival, and it's a big festival, a lot of people, and we were like, man, we got to get a jam going in our set, you know? So we watched Eric Sardinas played, and then Mark Ford played. And it was kind of funny, because after Mark's set, I went up to him and I think we had met his band, Mark Dutton, and I think it was Dennis, right? And mm-hmm. Elijah, his son, we met them at the hotel, and we hadn't met Mark, and Mark just got done crushing it, had a killer set. And I think if I remember right, I went up to him, I'm like, hey man, let's, you know, about having a jam. And he's like, something the extent of, well, I'd love to, but I just blew up all the amplifiers. So it was something to the effect of like whatever amp he had played through blue. And there was one other amp, and I remember kind of arguing with this guy from Spain that was loading the truck. I'm like, hey, can you leave that amp so we can have a jam? He's like, absolutely not. We got to take the gear and get out of here. So long story short, I had another amp, and we talked to Mark and we talked to Elijah, and we got my other amp set up on the other side of the stage. And actually Mark's son came out and jammed with us first. This is like a big, like a motor. It was like a biker fest in Spain, crazy scene in the mountains in Sestao, Spain.
Yeah. Don't forget the lesbian strippers that went on in between bands.
Well, yeah, I wasn't going to.
That's a whole other side story. Go ahead.
You can't have a festival without that, you know?
Yeah. Which is not in the norm, but anyway, so Elijah came up and jammed with us. Elijah, I think, was 17 years old at the time. And Mark was on the side of the stage, you know, like the proud dad watching Elijah jam. And then Mark got up with us. And I remember we played Cortez the Killer, like some 25 minute version of Cortez the Killer. I think Muddy got on the stage after that.
Well, Mark turned around to me after Cortez. We totally ripped the roof off. Well, there was no roof.
Yeah, it was a fun night.
But Mark turned around after Cortez, and we thought we were, you know, he would be on his way, but he turned around to me, and all he said to me was, try Alabama. It's kind of funky. And he started going into Alabama.
Oh, yeah, and then Oh, I think Mark Dutton had gotten on bass at that point, right?
Well, because our bass player, Todd, didn't necessarily know all the changes in Alabama perfectly. So he turned to Muddy, like, hey, you know this song? And Muddy kind of gave him the nod, like, yeah. So he just handed the bass off to Muddy. So now we're off we go, Jeff and I and Mark and Muddy playing Alabama for probably another 15 minutes or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And then long story short, Mark had to catch a plane. So by the time we were done with our set, those guys were all gone because they were going, I don't know where they were going, to Russia or somewhere in Europe. And then, but then we caught up with Mark again when we got home because we were opening for him in Chicago. And then that's when we really kind of, you know, got to know each other even more. And then myself and Todd, our former bass player, got up and played with Mark again that night. And then Joe and Todd, I think the next day, went up to Wisconsin and hung out with Mark. And that's when Mark was like, hey, man, if you guys, you know, if you ever find yourselves in California, you know, I'm producing records now. And, you know, I'd be interested in producing you guys if you guys can make it work. And we were all about it, of course, you know. Yeah, being huge Crows fans, Mark fans, and we're like, yeah, let's make it, let's do it.
Yeah, we actually went up to Mark's hotel room. He was playing a casino theater, and it was a weird gig. It was the night after our show in Chicago where we opened for him, and the gig that they were doing at the casino was him and his band did a set, and then the second set, it was like him and a dude from LA Guns and a dude from Jellyfish, and they were doing like a bunch of 70s covers, Muddy, and at the end of the night, everybody was going out, and Mark wasn't drinking or anything at that time. And he said, you could go out with those guys, or if you're, you know, if you aren't going to go with them, if you want to come up to my hotel, I'd like to play you this record by this guy, Ryan Bingham, that I just produced, if you'd like to check it out. And it wasn't out yet. So of course, Todd and myself, and the only reason Jeff wasn't there, Jeff had thrown his back out right before, remember, right before that,
yeah.
So Todd and I went up to Green Bay, and
how rock and roll is that? Throw your back out, being dead.
Part of the deal, man. Part of the hazards of the gig, right? Riding in the van or whatever. But
I guess
probably
from sitting in a van. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, we went up to Mark's room, and he played us the Ryan Bingham record that he had produced that wasn't out yet, and we really dug it. As did we dig the sound of like Weary and Wired and It's About Time and Mark's records. So not only was he, you know, like one of our heroes from being in the Black Crowes, we were already kind of, it was more about like, what could our record sound like? And, well, you know, what could Mark bring to the table that we could learn from him? Or we really liked the sound of his records and just his whole vibe, you know? So when he plays the Ryan Bingham record, we were just hoping and praying that he was gonna like say, hey, why don't you, what, you know, what are you guys doing for your next album? And he was real casual about it, but he kind of said, if you ever find yourself in California and are looking to make a record, look me up. And he kind of gave us his number. And to us, that was of course like the green light, like, holy shit, we got to figure out how to get the funds and get to California and make this record, you know? So, I mean, it was on a radar immediately, but it was really organic and natural how it all happened, for sure.
Did you record that at the compound?
We did.
Cause his records and his production style that he, at least on the stuff that he did there, very, very organic, like you were saying. And it seems to me like he likes to capture that live in the room feel, which I think is great. How did you find the experience of recording that whole record with him?
Yeah, it was well, he told us ahead of time. He's like, man, me and Anthony, who's the engineer on the record, he's like, our approach is really laid back. He's like, so don't freak out if you get here and there's days like you feel like we're not doing anything. Because, I mean, really, it was like windows open, 75-degree weather, Long Beach, California. And some days you'd show up at 10 in the morning and, you know, you'd have a cup of coffee and Mark would like, you know, what kind of tunes you got? We'd sit around the picnic table with acoustics. And sometimes we wouldn't start recording till 4 p.m. So it was he made it really relaxed and not like a high pressure. We got to get a record done. You got to do this. You got to be here at this time. It was very unlike that. And that method worked because we still managed to get the record done in what, less than 2 weeks?
Yeah, it was about 10 days. I think we were out there at the most.
Yeah, so it was really natural, and you know, it was cool because I think about half the record were songs that we brought in that Mark really didn't change, and then the other half was songs that he completely turned upside down and helped us rewrite. And then he even started playing, he played second guitar on the record because at the time we didn't have a second guitarist, and he would have an idea and just start playing, and I think it just morphed into him playing guitar with us on more than half the record. And like Joe keeps using the word organic, but it really was. We just showed up every day, tossed around ideas and hit the record button. And like you said, we recorded live. So there's bleed into some of the mics and that. And I don't think we used headphones. I think we had a monitor set up on the floor, like you're doing a gig and singing. And sometimes we'd keep the scratch vocal. Really cool experience. And Mark's a really intelligent producer. He listens to everybody, and you can tell from his experience that he knows how to put together a good song, and he knows how to create an atmosphere on how to make a great rock and roll record, for sure.
That's got to be interesting. He's like, yeah, you guys mind if I play guitar on this song? Yep, sure.
It wasn't even, yeah, but it wasn't even spoken. It was just like, he's looking at us like, do they want me playing on the record? And we're looking back at him like, of course we want you playing on the record. It wasn't even talked about. You know, like the song Waiting to Be Offended. It's like 15 minutes on the record, and we were all telling, like, man, do we have to edit that? We have to edit that. And Mark was like, well, if I were a Steepwater fan, I think I'd want to hear the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the discussion. So I guess we're putting a 15-minute song in the middle of our record. Just stuff like that, you know? It wasn't a lot of discussion. It just happened.
Yeah, but there were other songs out there. There's a song called Lord Knows. Lord knows you got to keep moving on. So keep moving on. It's like a 3.5 minute, just little cool little ditty.
Yep.
Yeah, right. that he really helped us rewrite. He got writing credits on that. We had the basic structure of it, but he kind of, like Jeff said, turned it upside down, and him and Jeff played some beautiful acoustics on it. And it was an experience for sure. And we learned a lot, man. We met a lot of people and we learned a lot. One of the guys that came by the studio was Scott from BMF Effects, who makes a lot of the effects pedals that Mark uses to this day, and turned Jeff onto a bunch of those pedals. And we're still friends with that dude. And don't forget Mike Malone, who played keyboards on it and has become a dear friend of ours as well. And, the whole experience was, just real natural and cool. It was fun.
So then on Clava, then, you have a song on there. So Ryan Bingham's record has this too, where there's a song on Ryan Bingham's record. That same song's on a Mark Ford record. They're different. They're the same song, but there's differences. You guys have the same sort of situation with Wake Up and Walk Away. He's got that song on one of his records. You've got it on Clava. How did that come to be where you guys were able to use that song and record it?
Well, it's a bonus track on Klava. So I think it's, I don't remember a big story behind it other than we just liked the song and started playing it.
I did not know that Ryan did that song. That happened.
No, Ryan and Mark have it. It's a similar situation. Mark has that song.
Oh, Mark, the other side that Ryan did.
Yeah, the other side. Okay, I see. We actually recorded Two Mules and a Rainbow with Mark, and that ended up going on a compilation record.
Compound studio, and then we started doing Wake Up and Walk Away on our live set just like for fun, and
just because we liked the song.
It was just fun to play, you know. And I think I maybe talked everybody into recording it because we were playing it so well. And then the two cover tunes that we recorded for that record in 2011 were Memo from Turner from the Stones and Wake Up and Walk Away. And for whatever reason, neither of them made the record. And then we took them and we put them on a 7-inch single that came out like later after Eric joined the band. And no rhyme or reason, just when you're in the studio, you try things. And sometimes, you know, I mean, you look back at it. And when I think about that, I think, why didn't we put one of those on the record? I don't even know who made that decision or why, because they're both really good recordings. It's just, I don't know.
Bring it back a little bit because the Crows have been kind of circling around Steep Border Band and for your entire existence. What's your where did your relationship start with the Black Crows?
For me, I got into them early when the first record came out and saw the first tour with Jellyfish opening at the Aragon Ballroom in 91. I did not catch them with Aerosmith or Heart or Robert Plant or any of that stuff. I don't know why, or ZZ Top. All those tours came through, and for whatever reason, I didn't. But I finally did get to the Aragon in 91. And actually, at that show, they brought Mark out to play Dreams. He happened to be traveling with them while Jeff Cease was still in the band. And they brought Mark out to play Dreams and maybe one other song at the end. And it was also a huge Jellyfish band. I was like, what was I, like 19 years old then? And literally, I used to tell people at that age, first year in college, I was like, I'm like, I only need four bands, the Beatles, the Stones, Black Crows, and Jellyfish. That's all you need. Like, that was my whole like thing, like that influenced what I wanted to do musically and what, you know, what I was into. And I did get to see Jellyfish a number of times. I saw them about four or five times. And, but anyway, that's where it all truly began. And then snowballed like it did for so many of us. By the time I saw OD Jubilee at Metro, and then by the time America Bus came around, I, you know, was like planning all my vacation time and all my extra money into let's go, and went to 15 shows that year or something, and then probably another 15 during.
Well, and John, but you kind of had a relationship with Johnny, was hooking you up, right?
Oh, that's another story. Yeah. On the Morker bus tour, Todd, our original bass player from Steepwater, and I were in Iowa. And like everybody at that time, we were hanging around a lot, meeting a lot of other people that were following the tour, and got yanked backstage and had a chance to say hi to everybody. And then wound up in Chicago the next night, and friend of a friend heard that they might be going to the Kingston Mines. And so we went looking for him after the Aragon show that year in for Morca or Bust, and ended up at Kingston Mines. Walked in the door. I'm not even joking. Walked in the door, and the security, it was me and Todd and our friend Dean, who's a film editor in Hollywood now. And the security guy looks at us and he's like, "Oh, you must be with those guys." And he pointed over to like this private section where the crows were all at. Like, and what were we going to say? No. So we're like, "Yeah, we're with them." And they took us to this private section and just like, it was roped off and like, open the rope and like let us in there, and nobody, it was like Steve and Mark, Chris and Ed and Johnny, Rich wasn't there, and they were all just like, "What's up, dudes?" And we just sat down with them, and probably like an hour into being there, the MC got on the stage and said, "We got some special guests in the house. We want to welcome the Black Crows to the stage now." And they got up, minus Rich, everybody, the whole band minus Rich, and did Shake Your Moneymaker and Woke Up This Morning from B.B. King and Chevrolet from Taj Mahal and whatever blues tunes they were doing at the time. And they did about a five Champagne song and Reefer, set. Man. Champagne and Reefer, and brought the house down. And so Todd and I hung out. We closed the bar with them. We were there till like 5 o'clock in the morning. And by the end of it, Todd had connected with Johnny. And Johnny was saying like, "Hey man, like let's hang out tomorrow night," because they were doing a two nighter at Aragon. So we went to Aragon the next night, and it just goes on and on and on and on, like it does for everybody that's listening to this right now in one way, shape, form, or another. I know, like it becomes, you know, like once you're in it, like it just becomes like a, I don't know, man. The Black Crowes are. It's impossible to not, when you feel it, it's impossible to not want to be there, you know? And so just kept going to shows. And then, we ended up meeting Jeff and a guy who was playing keyboards and guitar with him. They were trying to get a band going, and I met them at a crow show the following year at, the Aragon again for Three Snakes and, you know, whatever that was the basis of how I got going in it. And what about you, Jeff? I mean, you were always a fan as well, right?
I was always a fan, but I was kind of, I mean, I was more of a late bloomer. Like, I don't think I saw the Crows live until, I think my first Crows show was OD Jubilee. So that's pretty late in the game. Yeah, before
America. You were at that, though. I mean, that was pre-America. Yeah. And we were both there and didn't know each other, which is pretty crazy.
And then I haven't been to as many Crow shows as Joe, but I've been to a lot. And then I've been to a lot because I'm a huge fan as well, obviously. And then we opened for Rich a few times too. We ended up opening for Hookah Brown, which had John Hogg in it, way before Magpie Salute. And then we went back and opened for Rich again at in Chicago.
On the paper tour, right?
On the paper tour, yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of ties there besides we're just huge fans and have gotten the opportunity to actually play with a couple Crows. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and just think, Joe, if if that doorman hadn't stereotyped you, this whole thing might not have happened, you know?
That was wild, man. I mean, like, just the dude literally just, like, looked at us like, "Oh, you must be with those guys, huh?" And they pointed. We see them all sitting over there. We're like, yeah, we're with them. And we just went and hung out. And they were so welcoming. And we hung out and talked to everybody. And it was funny because, like, Ed was kind of busting our balls. He's like, "Isn't it past your bedtime?" Because we were pretty young guys, you know. And I turned to him and I go, "Me?" I'm like, "Oh," so I'm like, "Isn't it past your bedtime, old man?" And everybody started laughing, and like, you know, it was so cool to connect and I mean, it was good times, man. Those were the days of that band, man. That 94, 95, 96 lineup. Wow. Amazing.
But so, fast forward to the present day, you guys have a gig coming up supporting Mark Ford. It was a charity gig that he does pretty much annually at this point. Could you tell us a little bit about that, how you got involved with that?
I guess it's like the fifth annual one. So we had kind of heard about it. And there's a lot of people who go to it from like the New York, Boston, you know, that Northeast area, I guess, that are Crows fans. And a lot of my wife's friends, my wife Angela has a lot of friends in the whole Crows scene as well. That's a whole nother connection to it all that I've got. Is I wouldn't even be married to my wife if it wasn't for the Black Crows, which is kind of crazy. But we heard a lot about that thing. I know Mark did it acoustic a time or two, and then he started doing it electric. And last year, a friend fan, Jim from Chicago here, went, and apparently he was kind of talking us up to the promoter of the benefit, who his name is Jim also. And
Jim Galvin, yeah.
Yeah, Jim Galvin and Jim Marquardt is the guy from Chicago that went out there kind of like, I guess, you know, just speaking highly of us, saying like, you know, these guys. And I think Jim Galvin probably knew about us through our history with Mark and Grace and Melody and Mark producing us and us touring with Mark and things. And so, yeah, apparently, I mean, from what I hear, I don't know if can be public knowledge. It's not whatever. I mean, I guess he wanted to get the Bagmen and to open this year, but it didn't work in Luther's schedule, or they had prior commitments or something, I think, with the All-Stars. And so maybe we were right behind the Bagmen, as like he was either going to do Bagmen or Steepwater this year and or next, however it fell. And so we got the call and we're excited, and we're going to go out east and play a bunch of gigs and hook up with Mark and play the benefit, and should be really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that gig always seems like a lot of fun, and it definitely attracts longtime Crows fans. So, you know, you're kind of that's a built-in audience for you right there.
Have you ever tried to pull out a Crows cover? I mean, you guys play some pretty killer covers. The shows that I've been, whether it's been Stone songs or Bob Dylan songs or blues classics, you guys, to just kind of build you up a little bit, I would say, like, in the same equivalent way that we all laud how much the Crows will play a cover and sort of embrace it and make it their own and put their own little taste on it, right? You guys do that too. Double-sided question, you ever try to cover a Crows song, and how well did that go? And then also just talk in general about your selection of covers and how you go about deciding what you want to do.
You know, we have never done a Crows song, and I don't know why. Maybe we'll do that in the future. Like I said, we did two Mark Ford songs. We did two Mules and Wake Up and Walk Away, but we have never attempted a Black Crowes song, but that would probably be a fun thing to try. I'm definitely not against it. I mean, what a catalog to choose from. But knowing us, we'd probably choose some rare song that only you guys would recognize.
that's how we would want it, right? That's exactly. Yep.
I got a song that I want that I'd like to hear Jeff sing, and I would like to play. But it's not necessarily a Crowes song, but I've always wanted to do the song Sunday Sound. Yep. that New Chris Earth and Mark wrote together, New Earth. Yeah. Love. Yeah. And
yeah, that's a great song.
Yeah. I've always wanted to do that one. So that if I had a choice, that's like kind of like hanging around in my idea list. But yeah, we'd have to pick one. We'd have to figure it out. I don't know.
But yeah, to answer your question, I don't know why we choose the covers we choose. I mean, it just happens. I don't know. Somebody will start playing one at a rehearsal and it just fits. Or, you know, the reason we know so many Stone songs is because there was a Halloween show we did at the House of Blues in Chicago, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, where we did the entire Get Your Ya-Ya's album out.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And then we just, after that dissipated, you know, that whole idea, we just kept some of those songs around. It's just, I don't know, somebody will suggest something and sometimes it sticks, you know, somebody in the band, I mean, and sometimes it doesn't. Like sometimes we do Rhapsody in Red by Jerry Garcia.
It just knocks me.
which we just heard that on XM radio one day in the van, and Joe was like, man, that almost sounds like something we'd write. And I go, it does. So we learned it, you know, and then the random Dylan song or Muddy Waters song, it's just something that moves us that we think we can, I don't want to say justice, but think that that would work in our wheelhouse. But there's, you know, that's the only rhyme or reason to it.
Yeah, you said, that would sound like something that you wrote. What is your songwriting process? Like, how do you guys, do you write songs and then bring them to the group individually, or do you guys all collaboratively write stuff?
Well, I've narrowed it down to three ways. It's like, sometimes I'll write a whole song, the guitar parts and the melody and the lyrics, and then I'll bring it to the guys. And sometimes they'll say, just leave it. The arrangement's perfect. We love it. Rarely will I tell anybody what to play. Maybe once in a while I might have a drum beat idea or a bass line, but to me it's like the whole idea of being in a band is letting the other people do their thing and seeing what comes of it. So like when I say one of three ways, I'll come in with the whole song, and then the other idea is somebody else, you know, like Eric, our other guitar player, will give me a piece of music and it's up to me to write the lyrics and the melody. And then the third way would just be jamming. You know, jamming at a rehearsal and turning that into something. But generally, so the music could come from me or any source in the band, but the lyrics and the melody are generally up to me. But it's pretty much a group effort, and that's why we always split our writing credits, because it's a band. You know, I even heard, I saw an old Tom Petty interview where he says he never did demos. You know, he never sent the band demos because to him the Heartbreakers, he would always present the songs of the Heartbreakers on an acoustic guitar because he was always curious what they would come up with. So, I mean, if Tom Petty's saying that, that's a pretty valid point, you know? That's the whole point of being in a band, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that the collaborative nature of it is the most exciting part.
Yeah, and you can have an idea in your head, but you got to, you know, sometimes by staying open-minded, you might be surprised and somebody might, you know, oh, I never thought of that, and make the song better. So we try to stay open-minded between the four of us and see what happens, you know?
Now, you've talked about that you're touring on the East Coast out in May. It's the first time you've been out there in quite a while. Most of us generally catch you in the greater Chicago area because that's easily accessible to most of us that's on the call here. But the biggest thing currently that you guys are promoting is the two latest records you have, Turn of the Wheel and Return of the Wheel. I know I've talked to Joe quite a bit about that and the COVID project aspect of that, but can you just share with the listeners the writing and the recording of those two records and these two records stand above in terms of just general creative output? You guys are really hitting your stride. So I know those were a little different than normal because of COVID. So just talk about those records.
Well, thanks. Yeah. I mean, Turn of the Wheel and Return of the Wheel, even though Return of the Wheel is kind of a companion piece, they're definitely recorded different because Turn of the Wheel was before the pandemic where we could still get in a room together. Both those records were recorded at Joe's brother's studio in Miller Beach, Indiana. So Turn of the Wheel, it's his home studio. It's a great vibe. You know, we got a couple amps down in these bedrooms isolated, and we got the bass going direct, and we got the drums right in the room with us, and we're doing headphones. But Turn of the Wheel was more of a get in the room together and hash it out, you know, like a band, you know, like a rock and roll band should. And then Return of the Wheel, because of the circumstances, it was getting towards the end where things were opening up from the pandemic. Same studio, but we did it totally different in Turn of the Wheel because we went in just Joe and me and laid down guitar, vocals, and drums because it was still at the point where, you know, people weren't really hanging out in rooms together because of the COVID thing. So we recorded a bunch of tracks that way just to see how it would go. We weren't thinking about a record yet unless it came out, you know, because we were skeptical, like, can you do a record like that? Or, you know, we'd rather be live in a room. But then, you know, Eric has a studio at his house. Eric Saylor is our other guitar player. So he started sending over guitar tracks on top of what me and Joe did. And then Joe Bishop, our bass player, came in, started laying tracks on top of what me and Joe did. And to me, Return of the Wheel, it doesn't sound like we did it that way. For somehow it sounds like we're in the room together, but it started out as with me and Joe, you know, White Stripes style. Black Duo Jet style, Black Keys style. I don't know, just me and him, like a two-piece. And the other guys laid all their stuff on top of it, and it worked because of COVID. I can't say that we would do it like that again, but it worked out. I mean, I think Joe would agree. Like when I listen to it, it doesn't sound like it was piecemealed together like that, in my opinion.
No, it has a special vibe about it. And I don't know, like a lot of people are like, man, that one stands out, that record. Like it's just something really cool about it. And I don't know how we pulled it up. Jeff had been writing some songs during COVID and just kind of sending them to us on our phones, just like demos. And my wheels were turning, no pun intended, but I was like, man, we got to record this stuff. So when this thing ends, we have more like, we have something in the can and we're ready to go when COVID ends. So once it all started coming together, for better or worse, I don't know if I made the right choice or not. It could have been a whole brand new record, but I was like, what if we did an acoustic version of the title track and put it on the end?
Just a turn of the wheel and a slip of the brake. A job in a reel, mess them away. The diamonds are cracked and the silver fades. The man is a tramp at the end of the day. Where is the train you've been looking for? A means to an end, I was wanting more. The moment just a turn of the wheel, put your foot on the gas, into the now.
And called this like a companion to Turn of the Wheel, mostly to not take the focus off of Turn of the Wheel, because it came out in April of 20, right as COVID was hitting, and I wanted it to kind of all still get attention. So the main goal was to try to keep like the focus on the whole motif or the whole
It was like having two new records because we didn't get to tour on Turn of the Wheel.
Exactly Yeah. Like two new ones that kind of worked together and kind of had a similar vibe and artwork and all that stuff. I thought about calling it Turn of the Wheel 2, and then I didn't want to do the High Water 1, High Water 2, because that had all just happened, and Waterfall 1 and 2 for My Morning Jacket had just happened, and I was like, what if we did something kind of a little different? So we called it Return of the Wheel. And I think it maybe confused a few people because there's some people that are like, oh, is it just like the same record done with different artwork? And it's like, no, it's all different. It's part two. It's a whole nother record, you know, like, so whatever. People are still discovering it. And that's how our life is sometimes, is go out and play and get people to hear us play it live, and then they dial it up and figure it out, maybe buy it on vinyl or whatever. So there's still people ordering it, buying it at the shows, and it's all good stuff for sure.
Well, you've got my endorsement for it from that very journey. I was a late comer to the music, even though I've seen you guys around at the Crow shows in Chicago for 20 years.
Wow.
And been familiar on the fringe, but I just remember hearing Turn of the Wheel and thinking, okay, These guys are like, I got to get in and see this stuff more live. Obviously knew about your history with Mark. And then Return of the Wheel, I was scared, honestly, that you were doing like a Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 thing. I'm like, are these guys taking two records? They could make one good record. And each of them, honest to God, I'm not blowing smoke, stands on its own as a great album because they're so unique. And I love them. And I love seeing you guys play. I'll endorse seeing you live to anybody that asks me because it's such a good such a good catalog.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Speaking of playing live, I did want to go back to something Ian asked before, talking about your experience making records with Mark. And, you know, Justin and I are fortunate to see you play on stage with him a couple times. Saw you at Fitzgerald's up in Berwyn.
Yeah.
You talk about that unspoken connection, and it is just so much fun to watch. Do you guys still pick up something new every time you play with Mark on stage? Is something like just happens and you're like, wow, I didn't see that coming, but that was fun.
Yeah. There's something about Mark Ford's playing. I mean, he's really on a, I mean, I don't mean to blow smoke, but he's really on another level musically. you guys know. I mean, it's just the it's when you're playing with them, you want to play well, and you know that someone like Mark Ford is listening to everything, and it really becomes, and not that we don't play as a unit when it's just the four of us, but there's something about the way he spaces notes and what he doesn't play and the way he plays rhythm behind you that's going to lift up what you're playing as a guitar player. That's just really, really inspiring. And you can feel it. You can feel it on the stage, and it's just a blast, man. It's just a blast playing with him. You know, it's just, I don't know any other way to describe it. I mean, of course we have a blast playing with the four of us, and there's a certain amount of musical telepathy going on there from playing so many gigs together, but adding that element, it's just, everybody's so happy to be playing with him because we're all big fans, and he's going to add to what you're doing, and he's going to lift up what you're doing too, just by being himself and just playing the guitar the way he does, you know?
I've always said in many conversations that we have about Mark that he deserves to be in those conversations that people have about the top guitar players over the last 25, 30 years. And for some reason, he's not in that vocabulary. And it's such a shame because he is truly an underrated guitar player. He's one of the best I've ever seen for the reasons that you're describing, and just what he adds to music, but also what he doesn't play, you know, that is so important. And actually my co-host David usually brings up how Mark Ford tastefully plays, and David is so kindly opted to join us. He's
I got an excuse. Right. I got a story. I'm sorry, guys.
Hey, he's got a story. All right.
I've never even been late for a podcast ever. So in 5 years, I do apologize. Like, most unprofessional. I'm embarrassed, honestly.
It's all good. It's all good.
No, when Johnny was on a couple of weeks ago, we started talking about David Gilmour. David Gilmour is my favorite guitarist of all time. And Mark Ford is number two. And Johnny said he agreed with me. They have a lot in common in their playing with the way it's what they don't play. And then when they do play something, they make it matter. Do you guys kind of see the similarities with those two?
Absolutely. I mean, David Gilmour is one of my favorites too. Absolutely. And that shit ain't easy to do, man. They make it look easy, but as a guitar player, if you can move somebody with emotion with four notes instead of 500 notes, it ain't easy to do, let me tell you.
Rich had a interview the other day where he was asked about like all the shredders and stuff, and he goes, "Oh, they're super talented. They
sure absolutely
know more about music than me, can play, but can they make you feel it? Can they bend a note and hold it and just long enough to make you?"
I mean, I like all kinds of guitar playing. I like shredders. I like bluegrass players, people that can play their ass off fast. And Mark can play fast too when he feels like it. But in the end result, my favorite guitar playing deals with emotion. And you want to talk about emotion, David Gilmour and Mark Ford. I mean, come on. You know, you can feel it coming out of the speakers. And you can't put your finger sometimes on what it is. And that's kind of the beauty of it, right?
So can we translate that to then how do you, Jeff, when you're up there with Eric? Because to me, again, for those listening, if you haven't seen the magic happen on the stage, Deepwater Band is a two guitar attack that has interplay, and it has all of those elements that we love so much about these bands, like the Crows and like Black Rage Smoke and all of that sort of stuff. You guys have all that same element to you. And when I watch you and Eric up there playing your different parts and interweaving with each other, how does that come into fruition? Like, how do you figure out what part am I not going to play because he's going to play it? And how does that magic happen for those of us that just don't have a concept other than just watching? You said what you just said is so meaningful to me. Is like it looks so easy, but it's not. But when I'm standing there watching you, it looks super easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. It's just a lot of listening, man. Like, we were a trio for so many years, and I love playing as a trio, but I love playing with another guitar because I like to play rhythm guitar as well as lead. You know, there's a whole nother element there. And I like the challenge of, you know, well, okay, Eric's playing that chord in this spot, so I'm going to go play it up here to complement that. Or he's doing that note, so I'm going to play this note. So there's a certain amount of thought in it, and there's a certain amount of subconscious in it as well. Sometimes it's great not to think at all and just go for it. But I'm always trying to listen, not only Eric, but I listen to the drums, the bass. I'm listening to everything. and seeing what I could do to stay out of his way. And he's listening to what I can do, what he can do to stay out of my way. And then there's other times where we want to, you know, just not be in each other's way, but where it gets to a point where we're just playing together, and then you branch off. Some of it's not really describable. You know, it's just a lot of listening and being aware of the song and what's going on, because, you know, two guitar players fighting each other doesn't really sound too good.
So I got a great story. I got a great story about that. When Eric joined the band, well, when he initially came to jam with the band, he was in a band called the Healing Sixes that at one time had Jason Bonham as the drummer, which was a really cool band, by the way, but on a side note. But anyway, when we initially asked Eric to come jam with us, we did not rehearse because we had so many gigs on the calendar. At the time, we were playing like 175 nights a year. And I mean, we were moving. We were always in the van going. And we basically gave Eric like 60 songs. And we said, learn these 60 songs. Don't play what Jeff plays. The van's leaving Thursday. Like, we literally, that's how it went down. We're like, just learn these 60 tunes and don't play what Jeff plays. See you Thursday in the van. And we went. And them guys, those guys, they jumped on stage. And like Jeff said, it just kind of listening, it just kind of happened. You know, I don't know, because we probably didn't rehearse with Eric until we made Shake Your Faith. I don't, like, he was in the band for like a while, like a few years before we ever even rehearsed.
We're just playing gigs.
Yeah, and then, it was crazy.
And then Eric told me, he's like, well, you know, he would listen to the old songs that didn't have second guitars on them, and he would come up with these parts, and he would be like, well, I'm kind of approaching some of my parts like a keyboard player, which is really cool. So he just had, you know, any parts that he'd come up with were really original and were complementing mine. And now, whenever possible, we have Chris Grove, a keyboard player, with us. So now me and Eric are weaving around keyboards and that. You guys saw that at the Aurora show. So now there's another layer going on. And it's just, you know, I don't know. We just, as a band, whether it's four of us or five of us with Chris, you got to listen to each other and let it breathe at the times it needs to breathe. That's, you know, and some, maybe we fail at that some nights, but that's the goal, you know.
Imagine after a number of years playing as a trio to branch out and have other people there. It kind of gives a whole new, like, kind of maybe revitalizes you a bit and it makes you excited all over again. Is that the case?
I think so. And, you know, in some of our, and some, even when we were a trio, not so much Revelation Sunday, but like the, you know, like the record we did with Mark and all the records after that, you know, I would overdub other guitars and there'd be a keyboard on there, and then we would just strip it down live. But now when we have that, all that available to us live, yeah, it's a new dimension. And there's nothing wrong with being a trio, but we kind of did that already, you know, and now we get it. Once we got a taste of this, that's the direction we want to move forward. And the possibilities are so much broader, especially in the song department, you know.
Well, one of the most frustrating things for me as a music fan is when people record something and they can't play it live. Led Zeppelin. How many guitar parts is Jimmy Page putting on those albums? That, to me, is why the Crows tour worked so well. We had three people playing guitars, and that's the way those were intended to sound. And one of my favorite musicians of all time, top five musician of all time, is Jerry Cantrell of Alice in Chains. He has such a unique sound, unique vocal delivery. If you go see Alice in Chains, not with this incarnation, because William Duvall plays guitar, but if you went and saw them in the 90s, the live presentation, when you got to these awesome solos, it was just so thin and weak, like on wood, you know?
Yeah.
And to me, having somebody playing another part, it's kind of like whoever's playing the rhythm is like painting a tapestry, and whoever's doing the lead is going to, you know, come and do what they need to do. But it's that constant in the background that keeps the sound full. And to me, it's much more pleasing.
Yeah, it's like a wall of sound back there. You know, it just like I said, I got nothing against a trio or even a band that overdubs guitars, and they, you know, they got the one guitar live. But it's really a cool thing on stage to have all that going on, and you play different. You know, you can lay back and get into the song maybe a little more with those extra instruments going on. Joe probably agrees with me, I would think.
Yeah, I loved it when I was able to connect with Jeff on when he was playing rhythm guitar, like when Eric joined, and and I was able to have that constant rhythm going on, like it really just made our whole backbeat, our whole vibe, just like that much more punchy and powerful. And you can lock into certain things. Sometimes Jeff and I will accent things together in kind of like a Faces kind of Stonesy kind of way, you know, and I do that with Eric as well, you know, where like whoever's playing lead is busy doing their thing. And there's all kinds of accenting and things that can happen underneath all that. So yeah, it's definitely cool and fun and fuller and all that stuff. Definitely
the same lines as like Government Mule, you know, they kind of expanded their membership, and then it adds a whole new dimension. But as far as performing live, what you know, if people are going to attend the charity gigs and anything you got coming up, what should new fans expect to see?
Well, we're just going to go put on, you know, a good rock and roll show. We never play the same set twice, you know, in honor of bands like the Black Crowes and the Grateful Dead.
Government so Mule, forth. You just said.
We
toured with the Mule in 2010, and man, they mixed their sets up like big time. Like they might not even play the same song like three or four nights in a row. You might not hear like a repeated song. You know?
Yeah. So when we pull up to that gig that night, it'll be whatever, you know, we come up with for the set list that night and whatever we feel like doing. But, you know, it's probably three or four core tunes that we play every night. But besides that, it'll be a revolving door. But all I can say is, you know, we're there to play, and we will put 100% into it when we're there, because we do it every night. That's the whole reason you ride all those miles to get to the gig, is to get on the stage. So and it sounds like, to me, it sounds like the vibe at that place is a bunch of people that are going to be really ready to hear what we're going to play. So that makes it all the better, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what are you guys working on now? I know, obviously, you got the gigs here, the East Coast trip, the benefit concert. What are the next steps for Steepwater Band? What are we going to look forward to in the next year or so?
Well, we actually started rehearsing, which we don't do too often.
Ever?
You know, because we play so many gigs. We actually started working on some new material, and it's going really well. We don't have specific plans for recording yet, but it should be interesting, because it looks like, you know, as at the time we go on this East Coast run, it looks like we're gearing up for a busy year. Like we're going back to Spain to play some festivals, and there's some talks of things in Europe in the fall that are coming together, and a lot of Midwest shows. But basically, it's going to be playing a lot of gigs and trying to get material together and figuring out where we want to record our next record with, and whether we want to do it on our own or do another record with Joe's brother, which is Jim Winters, which has worked out great for the past two records. So we're basically just writing right now, and going to come up with a plan the next few months as to getting some stuff recorded.
Yeah, it'll be good to see Mark in May, because depending on what his plans are, I know he's playing with Lucinda a little bit now. And
he just recorded an album with her.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, there might be some banter to see what his schedule looks like. And if you never know, maybe we'll end up seeing if he wants to do some stuff again, because we're due for that, maybe, or whoever else might be around. I you never know. There was one point in our lives where the drummer from Blues Traveler wanted to take us to Ireland to an old abandoned church and record a record and produce us. And this banter yeah. went on for about a year, where we thought we were going to Ireland with the drummer from Blues Traveler to make a record. And then when budgeting all started coming together, it just like didn't seem between yeah, that. Well, yeah, go ahead.
We were trying to get somebody to pay for it.
Yeah. Well, there was that, but then
we were going to pay for a trip to Ireland, then, right?
Yeah, exactly. But also, we sent the producer who produced our Clava album, Colin Sipes, we sent him to meet with the Blues Traveler drummer. What's his name? Is Brendan, right? Was it Brendan or Brandon? Mm-hmm. Brendan. So we sent our producer from the Clava album to go meet with Brendan at a gig at House of Blues in Chicago. And Brendan told him the plans, and he came back to us, our producer guy, Colin, and he said, man, I just think this whole idea to have the right equipment there, the right soundproofing, everything else, like seems like a pretty big challenge, like a big, like, and you know, has he ever even attempted anything like this? So once we really started thinking about it and the budget started coming together, we were like, maybe we're not going to do this, you know? So I'm just saying, some wild things come about. You never know who you're going to run into, or that was the craziest thing. We were playing a gig and the guys from Blues Traveler had played a gig in the same town that we had played in, Joliet, Illinois. And they were sitting outside the bar where we were playing, listening to us. And then we went on break. We were doing two sets and we went on break and they were like, man, you guys are killer. Next thing you know, we're on tour opening for those guys in Texas, you know, like, you just never know like what's around the corner. So we don't really ever count out working with a producer or making a record for a label or someone we've worked with in the past, or maybe doing it ourselves. We just try to take it as it comes and whatever comes like organically and naturally. But we do need to make some decisions by the fall as far as getting in and starting to hit record, because time moves fast and you look up, it's already been 2 years since Return of the Wheel came out, and mostly just so we can keep the van on the road and keep touring and keep playing. You always kind of need like a new thing that you're promoting. So look forward to getting something together, and we do have about 6 or 7 new songs kind of hanging around right now. So
I'll give you a ringing endorsement for anybody that hasn't seen Steepwater Band live. Make it a priority. It looks like you guys got a swing on the East Coast there, like you talked about, in May, and then a couple more dates here in the Midwest, Illinois area before heading off to Spain. Just cannot tell you how much I enjoy the live show. So
well, cool.
I really recommend anybody thinking about it.
Thank you, Sean. Thanks. So Jeff and I are riding out to Iowa tomorrow night for the first Blackberry Smoke show since Britt's passing.
Oh yeah.
We're going tomorrow.
They invited us, and we're gonna go out there and hopefully get a chance to say hey and give our condolences, but also enjoy the show.
Yeah. Super. Yeah. What's funny is I posted something on our Instagram or whatever. And I'm a huge Atlanta Braves fan, and obviously they're from there. And Britt likes the Braves. I think that's how it started. And he like sent something back to me, whatever. And it was during COVID. I said, hey, man, door's always open. He's like, yeah, when you want to do it. And he did it. And then Charlie kind of happened the same way. I think he started following us. And I was like, hey, man, you know, really appreciate you following the show, and you know, if you ever want to talk to, he's like, yeah, when you want to do it. So they've had some great stories. It's really sad. I never actually got to meet Britt. I've met Charlie before, and he was a very big supporter very early on of the podcast, and it's sad. Sven on our interview, he choked up talking about him.
Wow. He was a great dude.
We met him in 2007. We were all playing on the Lynyrd Skynyrd cruise together. And I bumped into him in the casino. And it's funny how I met him. We were rolling craps. We were rolling dice. And he was rolling dice. And he kept rolling the right numbers for one of my other buddies. And my other buddy was winning money and calling Britt the Beard of Power. He was yelling, Beard of Power! and so Britt and I started talking after we gambled for whatever till the wee hours. And one of the first things we talked about, Britt was close with Johnny Cole. And I told him I knew Johnny from back in the day. And that was kind of how we struck up talking originally. Like at the time, Blackberry Smoke was only Charlie and Britt and Richard and Paul. They didn't even have a keyboard player. They were a 4-piece and we were a 3-piece. And we stayed in touch every time they'd come through Chicago. Like often if I didn't have a gig, I would go see them at like Joe's on Weed Street. And I mean, sometimes there'd be 10 people there, like they, you know, before they got it going. And once their things started taking off, you know, eventually they asked us to come play some shows on tour with them in 2016, which was really, really cool. But they are some of the hardest working, coolest people that we have ever come across in music. And it's just heartbreaking, man. It really is. I kept in touch with Britt during, you know, throughout his fight. And man, I couldn't even believe he was on the road last year playing gigs, but he wanted to do what he wanted to do, what, regardless of where it was going to, you know, where his illness was going to take him. And he played all the gigs, and he would do treatments. And if he had to do treatments, the drummer who's playing now, Kent Aberley, was his drum tech. He would stand in and play the shows. And it was just very heartbreaking, man. This has been a really tough time for sure. I don't know if you guys saw, but I just did the All Blues and Southern Rock podcast tribute. They asked me to come on that, and I did that like the day after or whatever. And that wasn't easy either, but I never know. I don't know. I mean, 57 is, we're all right around that. I mean, how everybody here is probably right in our 50s, right? Or close. Except for you there, David. You look like you're about what, 12, 14?
David's Benjamin Button. He's reversed.
I'm actually 47. I get accused of being in my mid 30s all the time.
You look younger for sure. Thank you.
Yeah, good moisturizer.
Oh, that's your secret all this time, David. I never knew.
Yeah, Jergens.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure having you guys on, and we really appreciate it. And it's, of course, an open door here anytime you want to come back.
Thanks for having us, man.
We have, as a corresponding release with this, when it comes out on the main pod, Justin and I actually spent some time. We did an extended Patreon radio. So for our listeners, we do that occasionally where we walk through some of our favorite topics, or in this case, one of our favorite bands. And we just did a career retrospective of you guys. We walked through album by album and kind of picked some awesome of our highlights. And so that's going to release on our Patreon at the same time that this releases, to just give everybody some context of why we love you guys so much and why they should also.
Well, thanks, man. That's awesome.
Yeah, it really means a lot to be recognized by you guys, seriously, because like I said earlier, whatever rant I was on, I mean, it's in my blood, you know. I mean, I've been part of this thing since 1991, and one time when we were opening for Rich, and this is a terrible thing to say, but it's funny. We were hanging out with Rich when we opened for him, and we were talking about, like,
I know what you're going to say.
You know where I'm going. We're talking about his brother's music and his music and blah, blah, blah. And I go, man, the Crows are like, it's like being a Crows fan is like being a Cub fan. You love them even when they suck. And I said it right there, Rich, and Rich just kind of started laughing, you know, like, and whatever. I mean, I like some of CRB, and I like some of New Earth Mud, but didn't love it all, but I still would put it on, you know what I mean?
Well, even when they quote unquote suck, it's better than most bands. So they never really sucks.
whatever, you know, but I'm a little bummed that Steve's not in the thing. I could go on and on like we all could, but whatever. I'm super stoked to get a chance to meet you guys and be on this. So thank you guys, really. And thanks for what you're doing to, you know, keep something for all the old time, the old school Crows people, and probably lots of new people that are coming on board all the time too, you know, so
you'd be surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So just keeping everybody in the loop and giving everybody something to listen to and get excited about, like regarding the Black Crows and the whole community. And it's very cool. So thanks for doing what you guys are doing, and thanks for including us. It's awesome.
Well, we usually let our guests pick a playout song, and since there's two of you gentlemen, we're going to do two. Why don't you pick a Steep Water track that's a particular favorite of yours?
Pick one of our own tunes?
Yeah, man.
How about, I like playing Big Pictures. I like Big Pictures.
Alrighty. And you, Joe?
Yeah.
Right now, probably my favorite song is called Found. It's from our latest record, Return of the Wheel. Found.
All right. Perfect. And since we make our own rules around here, give us a Crow song to put at the end of that. Something deep.
Feathers is my favorite Crow song. Right. Feathers are available.
Yeah, that's a great. That's perfect. But mine is
Thorn of My Pride is my favorite, but Feathers is a close second.
and Peace Anyway is one of my all-time. I probably said that last time I did this.
Yeah.
So, all right, it's going to be a long playout on this one.
I know. People are going to be like, well, this episode's 2 hours long.
It'll be fine.
No, to me, the guitar playing, man, the both Rich and Ford, I mean, the whole band, but Rich and Ford's moody guitar playing on Feathers. I love that shit.
It's pretty amazing. But again, thank you so much, guys, and we really appreciate it. And Jason, why don't you take us out?
Stay tall, everybody. We'll be right back.
clean again. And I do not waste myself. And I cannot spare a grain, because it's bad blood time again.
We find ourselves here now. Me and you, baby. So you see.